Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Welcome to another episode of the Self-Build Plus podcast, where we chat with self-builders, suppliers, and experts about all things home building and renovating in Ireland on both sides of the border. I'm Astrid Mattsson, your host and the editor of Self-Build Magazine. So I'm lucky to be joined by longtime magazine contributor Patrick Waterfield. He's here to chat about what it takes to build an eco house without breaking the bank. So, I mean, just to get us started, I suppose it wasn't really too long ago, maybe a decade or even less, that building an eco house kind of meant having to pay more, really, than the average construction cost. So it was like pretty much specialist work. You had advisors, you had tradesmen, everyone had to be kind of quite specialist, and the materials did as well. So everything kind of came at a premium. But the costs have come down, obviously, and the building regulations in the Republic probably had a little bit to do with that, making eco features pretty much mandatory. But I suppose, you know, building a house to make it cheap to run doesn't really necessarily make it green from the point of view of other eco credentials, as in how eco-friendly the materials you use actually are. So, Patrick, it's probably a good idea to start off with kind of definitions, as always, and try to frame the narrative there and just what we mean by an eco house. So just the difference between an energy efficient house and the more broadly defined eco house in the sense of life cycle analyses and from that point of view.
Yeah, no, thanks, Astrid, and welcome, everyone. Pleasure to be here live for once. A bit different from just writing an article and having Astrid cut it to bits and then publish it in the magazine. So we'll see how it goes. Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's I would say simply an energy efficient house is something, a concept that everybody understands. It's just a matter of degrees. Energy efficient. How energy efficient? How energy efficient compared to what? Compared to what it used to be for a refurb, maybe compared to the minimum standard in the building regulations, compared to other houses in the area or in the country, that kind of thing. So I think we understand energy efficiency. As I say, it's just a matter of degrees.
But would you say energy efficiency can be equated as cheap to run, basically cheap bills, cheap energy bills at the end of the day, like from the homeowner point of view?
Absolutely. And you know, the cost driver, you know, has got to be there. And maybe in past years, it really wasn't. You know, as somebody once said, energy was too darn cheap. It's not so cheap now, maybe, and it's not going to be getting any cheaper into the future. So, yes, there's always a cost driver. The definition of eco house, as you said, is much more difficult to pin down and could mean a lot of different things to different people. I mean, I would like to think that any house called an eco house would also be an energy efficient house. But depending on where you're coming from, you know, your focus, you may be looking at other things. You mentioned materials quite rightly. Some people would say you can't have an eco house unless you have natural materials. You can't have an eco house with oil-based insulation or stuff like that. And then maybe what about renewables? What about water consumption? There's a whole lot of ecological issues that come up when you're designing and building a house. So I think that's it's a harder one to pin down,
yeah, and to define, because really, I suppose what we've been using as a definition in Ireland for the past while is this passive house standard is kind of a great way to simplify what an energy efficient house means to a certain extent. I suppose, would that be a good indicator? Is that a good benchmark to work to?
It's an excellent benchmark, and has been for some while. It set the standards, defined the standards, and helped raise awareness about what an energy efficient and possibly eco house could be. And it's very well used and very well known in a lot of countries worldwide. I think that the thing about a passive house is, I'm sure we'll come on to mentioning my house, throughout this transmission, but I designed and built my house to a similar kind of standard, but I didn't go for the passive house certification. And there was a reason for that. And it was to do with the kind of components and systems that you need to have in, to get your passive house certification. And obviously, from the passive house point of view, Passive House Institute, that allows them to more closely regulate their brand, their certification, and they need to do that. But often these components will come at a cost premium. And yes, I was certainly interested in the cost. It's funny, I've all through my working life, I've been trying to tell other people how to spend their money on their buildings. And when it came to, putting my own money where my mouth is, it was an interesting experience. But more than that, I wanted to show that you could build a house that was incredibly energy efficient and eco-friendly from industry standard components without necessarily having to go looking for these very high performing and generally more highly priced components. So I think that's one thing that's worth highlighting. Now, the plus side of Passive House Institute is when I built my house, I said it was energy efficient. I didn't necessarily say it was eco, but somebody might have said, well, you might say it's eco, but so says who? Now, if you have a passive house and you have the certification, you can say the Passive House Institute says, Professor Wolfgang Feist and the whole institute and all the experience that they put in to researching and defining their standards, And that carries a lot of weight. So I think, there's
pros merit and cons. To it.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I think most people don't really care about getting the certificate. They want a house that is energy efficient and cheap to run and relatively eco-friendly, whatever that means for them. I suppose it is a question of choice, not using too much water, as you said, or materials, things like that. There is an element of personal choice in that. There's nothing like forcing us to do any of that yet, really, to any significant extent. But just, I'm interested, so going back to your own house, when you're saying that you had that cost analysis and you had that cost brain on, what didn't you put in? Like, because passive house does have that requirement of having mechanical ventilation with heat recovery, which most people do nowadays in the Republic in new builds. So was that, did you change the ventilation system, or was there, what did you change? What was required and what did you do?
I do have a mechanical ventilation with heat recovery. And I mean, if I could sort of maybe, address one of the starting points, I think it is always got to be insulation. You try and get the heat requirement, heating requirement of the house, down as far as possible, or as far as sensible, at least. And that, of course, means looking at your building fabric, your walls, roof, floor, windows as well, of course. But once you've done that, you start looking at that, then you need to look at the heat loss that occurs by ventilation. Otherwise, it's like the proverbial bucket with two holes in the bottom, and you only fix one of them. The water is still going to leak out, and or in this case, the heat and the energy and the money. When you start doing that and you tighten up your building fabric, you know, to make it airtight, you need to make sure not only that you're not having too much ventilation, but importantly that you don't have too little. And I think that's where the mechanical ventilation system comes in, because you can design in the ventilation correctly, make sure you've got enough, and you can also then harness the waste heat which would otherwise be lost. And that in turn feeds back and reduces again the heating requirement of the house. So it's a nice little circular situation there. So yeah, I definitely have a mechanical ventilation system with heat recovery.
So what was it that made you not tick the boxes for a passive house? Because I presume you insulated and made the house airtight so that
absolutely
you met all those requirements. I also
ran the house through the PHPP software, which is an excellent tool.
The passive house planning package. Yeah.
Correct. Yes. What I think, as I say, made me stop short of that was, as I say, what I wanted to do was to show that I could assemble a house which performed to the same kind of level from components that were readily available locally. And that I did manage to do. So while my overall heating requirement was actually below the threshold for passive house, it didn't perform to passive house standards in other aspects. For example, my windows were not as low U value as a passive house would require. My airtightness was not as low as a passive house standard. So in the case of the windows, that was an interesting one, because I did actually end up going for PVC windows, and I didn't think I would do that. If somebody had told me a couple of years before, I would have said, no, I want nice timber windows, maybe aluminium exterior with timber internally. But in the end, the cost argument was so persuasive. Instead of costing me about 30,000 euro for all the windows in a house, mine cost about 7. You know, it's hard to argue with that. And I have to say, they've performed extremely well. Triple glazed, thermally, they're really excellent. The sound insulation value also is very noticeable. When it's blowing a gale outside, it's really calm and still inside. And the PVC windows are extremely low maintenance and look just about as good today as they did 12 years ago.
So I know we covered this in the current edition of the magazine, but how much are you spending like a year on average, or what's your energy usage? Did it deliver on what your expectations? Because you've been in for a good while now.
Yes, I had to scratch my head a bit and think about that, because first of all, I should explain that my focus, and I'm not dodging your question, I will come back to it, my focus was in designing out the central heating system. So I had to get my fabric U values and of course my ventilation heat loss way down as far as I possibly could. So that meant a lot of insulation. It meant the triple glazing. It meant the mechanical ventilation with heat recovery. And I reckoned if I could get my building fabric U value down to about 0.2 watts per square meter K, then I reckoned I could do away with the central heating system. For a start, I went for a timber frame. I went for a 150 mil stud. Some insulation in the cavity with a block, render block outer leaf, some insulation inside the stud as well, dry lining, a lot of insulation in the roof and the floor, of course, triple glazing, as I've said. So that was to get my U value right down. So the house does not have a boiler or a heat pump. It doesn't have radiators or underfloor heating. It has a fairly small wood burner in the main living area, and it relies on the heat. It's fairly open plan, also from ground floor to first floor, so heat is able to rise through thermal buoyancy, and otherwise it's distributed around the house via the mechanical ventilation system. So
yeah, and that works, and it's comfortable.
It works really well. I did a couple of other
things. And that saves a lot. I mean, between the underfloor, the heat pump, I mean, that's
people have always been coming into the house over the years at certain times of the year, and they look around and they say there's no radiators on the wall, and they say, oh, underfloor heating then. No underfloor, no heating. What I've found is that if the house has been, if it's continually occupied, then, you know, you build up some thermal mass. I did build some thermal mass into the house in the form of a kind of large ingle nook around the wood burner to help heat that up and hold some heat within the building. Because one of the things about timber frame buildings, they're well insulated, they're quick response, but they don't maybe hold the heat so well within the fabric, internal fabric of the building.
So it's made of bricks. Your little heat store in the
yes,
masonry.
It's made of block.
It's a brick
it's,
one.
It's
block. Oh, it's blocks.
It's,
yeah.
Yes, it's dense block. And you know that works pretty well. So
it's a bench, or what is it? Would you sit on it and it's warm? Kind of, it keeps.
No, it's not. There's a like a wall. This feature is about 3.5 meters long. It's like there's a wall at the back of the wood burner. It then turns in. At the ends, and then turns back on itself a short amount, so it makes a kind of ingle nook like you see on the old houses, sort of big fireplaces, a lot of thermal mass, a lot of block or maybe stone in that case around it, which sort of helps, when you have a fire, radiant heat, it radiates out, heats up that thermal mass, and helps to stabilize the temperature within the space. So that works pretty well. I find that after the house has been occupied for 2 or 3 days, I really hardly need to run the wood burner at all, even in the middle of winter. The heat generated by people just cooking, maybe taking showers or whatever, all that again is scavenged through the heat recovery system, and about maybe 75% of it thereabouts returned back into the house. So I found it works very well. So when I talk about heating costs, you have to understand I don't have any gas, I don't have any oil, I have wood blocks, and that's kind of it.
So you get kiln-dried timber? What do you use the wood burner?
Indeed. It wouldn't necessarily need to be kiln-dried, but it would need to be well-seasoned. It would need to be maybe air-dried. Certainly don't try and burn green timber in your wood burner, because it really won't work very well. So you ideally want timber which was cut from the year before and has been stacked and well air dried. Kiln dried, yes, you can do that, but certainly you need to get it with a low water content, and then you'll find you get a good calorific value out of it. And also, importantly, you don't end up gumming up the flue and corroding the inside of your wood burner so much. So
So then you gotta. So would you pay for that, or do you have your own timber that you yourself dry in the shed? And
certainly not. I don't have that. So
DIY.
I do pay for it. No, I do pay for it. So I probably pay about €500 a year, something like that, for my timber. And then I have electricity, because I have all LEDs throughout the house. And 12 years ago, that was not a simple, straightforward matter. I tried to get people to design a lighting system for me, and nobody could do it. Now, of course, LEDs are more or less kind of standard issue these days. So it shows how quickly things have changed. But back then, it was hard to get a hold of things. It was hard to get anyone to tell you how many you needed in a particular space. So I had to kind of research that and do it all myself. And I'm happy to say it worked pretty well. So, you know, my lighting is all low energy. I have the mechanical ventilation heat recovery system. I have other continuous loads would be, I have a little mini water treatment system instead of a septic tank. So that's continuously agitating and then sort of runs into a percolating area. And apparently the stuff that comes out of this, it's a three-chamber system. You could discharge, well, you can discharge it straight into a public water course. Apparently, you could drink it. I haven't tried, but
no, I wouldn't.
It's supposed to be very, very well treated. So that's a continuous load. And then otherwise, you just have normal domestic loads. Yeah. You know, you have your kitchen, refrigeration, freezer, stuff like that. I have one electric shower. My other shower is run because my wood burner has a back boiler. Okay, so that's important. I think in many ways, you know, to try and get more out of your system. So anytime you're heating up the wood burner to raise heat, to heat the space, I'm also raising hot water that goes up into the tank and that feeds one of my showers. Now, also, I found actually that in the wintertime, if I'd been in a house, if it was pretty cold, I was running the wood burner, you know, fairly well, but not drawing off the hot water. I actually had too much hot water in my tank. So I actually, you know, the way a hot water cylinder has maybe at least two coils. Typically, you would have one connected to your boiler, for example, and the other could be connected to some, you know, solar tubes, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Well, I have the solar tubes, but I don't have the boiler. So I had a free coil. So I was able to reverse pump out of the tank into two towel radiators in the bathrooms, heat the bathrooms. Then, of course, because I'm extracting heat from them all the time with the ventilation system, I'm actually recovering some of that heat and putting it back into the house. So again, that was another way of balancing the whole house. And that works very well.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Well.
Okay. And so that's all your hot water needs. Obviously, you actually have cases where you have too much hot water.
Almost as I say, I found then that because I was able to take the heat off the tank you know, put it into the towel radiators, and then the heat from them was returned through the ventilation system back into the house, that reduced the burden on the wood burner. So I was able to run that lower, and therefore, you know, that
generate less hot water.
Generate less hot water. Yeah, absolutely.
But then in the summer, obviously, you don't necessarily want to light your wood burner, especially with the heat, to get hot water.
Out. Like you'd have to, you know, throw the windows open. Absolutely. So I've got these solar tubes, and they work really well. I went for tubes in particular because the orientation of the house was determined by various things, but it ended up being kind of southwest. So if you're directly south, then maybe a flat plate will be as good on average over the year. If you're maybe you know, southeast, southwest, I think the tubes perform better with you know, from different orientations. And I have to say they've worked very, very well. So,
and the immersion, does it have to come on at all to for hot water with the solar tubes, if that's your only source in summer?
I would say the solar tubes and the wood burner between them seasonally have done almost all the hot water I have needed. I would honestly say that I could count the times I switched the electric immersion on the fingers of one hand. It's there if you need it, but you know, and of course there may be times, you know, in the summertime, as you say, maybe warm outside, but the sun's not quite doing the business. You know, that could happen. So, you know, it makes sense to have a backup.
Yeah, yeah. And so your electricity bills, did you say then? On average, so
that was about, no, let me see. That comes every couple of months, doesn't it?
Oftentimes it depends on
the supplier. That's right. So it varies, but I think it would say it would be about between 75 and 100 euro.
Right.
So,
that's not too bad.
So, that's.
And that's with only 0.2 U value.
0.2 is the average for all of the fabric. Now, you can build a house now.
The roof is much better and the walls are a bit less, or?
Yes, well, you see, that includes the glazing. So, if you have triple glazing, if you have passive house standard glazing, you might have 0.7. But if your glazing is 20% of your walls, that's going to make a big contribution. So I'm trying to get the whole thing, including the glazing, down to 0.2. So you know you've got a limit on the glazing. That puts the pressure on all the rest of it. That's why I've got, 300 mil practically of insulation in the walls and the roof and the floor.
So then the best investment obviously is, as always, the insulation, the airtightness, and your windows, I guess. I mean, it is the whole thing of the fabric, as opposed to then starting to try and go and invest in all these bolt-on things that you might not necessarily need. I suppose you do need to invest in the mechanical ventilation with heat recovery, don't you?
You do.
It is mechanized, though. What if there's a power cut? That's always the question.
Well, if there's a power cut, then, I mean, you know, the systems generally fail to an open system, so you won't be starved of ventilation. You won't obviously have the heat recovery aspect, so you'd lose that. Power cuts actually is interesting, you should say, because thankfully, they don't seem to be so much of a feature of our lives these days, but who knows. In the past, they have been. So one thing that I did when, regarding the back boiler on the wood burner, I didn't have a pump on it. Instead, I have inch gauge copper pipes leading up as directly, as straight and vertically as possible from the back boiler up to my hot water tank. And that allows the water to rise out of the back boiler by thermal buoyancy up into the tank, and the cooler water then naturally falls down the return leg, and the whole thing works perfectly well without a pump. Because I did wonder what would happen if there was a power cut and my pump failed. I would have an issue with the back boiler. It would start to overheat. I would have to douse the fire, and then I would lose my heating as well as my hot water. But the way I've done it is simple. And I think that's a good watchword. I remember shortly before I built my house, I was lucky enough to be invited on a study tour. I think I've mentioned this in your magazine before, a study tour to Denmark by the company that makes Velux windows, Velfac. And they had a demonstration house there, which was really fantastic. I mean, it was a showcase for their products, I guess. And it had, automated windows, automatically opening for ventilation. It had a heat pump. It had everything, basically. And it was very impressive. But I came away from that thinking, my gosh, that's very complicated. I mean, it'd be very expensive.
All the
controls, what happens when things start to go wrong, the maintenance, So I was determined to make my house low maintenance, future proof. Don't overcomplicate it.
Yeah. Unless things can go wrong, then obviously, as you say. Yeah, and I suppose, I guess the other point to touch upon, you built with timber frame. So there's more, you know, there's obviously more quality control that can be, because, you know, you have the timber frame company usually that erects it on site, and there's, you know, everything's kind of much more precise than, let's say, block work. I mean, there are issues with installation. People think they might be getting a really good U value on their wall, but if, you know, there, it wasn't, if the insulation wasn't put on properly, really carefully, like, you know, against the inside block, and that there's no mortar at all, and that, you know, there can't be any thermal things happening in there, that means that your insulation basically is halved. So there is, like, how can people actually, I know it's, you know, but like it is an issue of trying to just warn people that, you know, you might, something might look great on paper, but you know, it is all about the installation. So absolutely, you know, and for block work especially, like, is there any tips, advice that people can you know, turn to, or like just have a really good, I guess, maybe project manager on site, or obviously self-builders tend to oversee it themselves and rely on the expertise of the tradesmen. So it's kind of, you know, you don't want to tell the builder what, you know, like, what do you know about building? Like, the builder should know, but like, how do you know that, you know?
That's really the crux of it, isn't it? You know, are you going to get you know, the house that you expect, that you've you know, that you want? Okay, but timber frame, yes, generally, I mean, it is possible to have timber frame that's more self-build. You actually put the thing together on site. But generally speaking, you're talking about factory fabricated panels, say, for example, and they will have, you know, the weatherproof outer membrane already in place. They get craned into position, mechanically fixed together, and then the insulation, and then the interior membrane, the internal air tightness membrane, and that is all extremely important. That all needs to be done, absolutely. And if it isn't, your air tightness test will pick it up. So
at least you have that. Yeah,
you do. Now, I think when it comes to looking for a builder, I mean, I've been asked this question so many times, you know, how do I find a builder who can build an energy efficient house? Well, I would say a builder who builds to quality can build an energy efficient house, but you need to sit down, have the conversation with them, explain what it is you're trying to do. And if you're not happy that they understand it or are happy to go along with it, then you go looking for a different builder. Go ask to go looking at some houses that they have built. Look at the quality if you can. We did have some building work, obviously, some block work. I wasn't really relying on it in this case, either structurally or for a thermal or airtight membrane. But I was very happy to see even the parts of the block work which were never going to be visible. All the mortar joints were perfectly struck and really clean, and that was a really good sign. That's the quality that you need, because block, conventional block, people may not know this, it's not even airtight. Standard block. So if you've got,
it's the plaster that gives the airtightness layer,
correct,
isn't it?
So you really want a scratch coat at least that covers the whole of the internal surface of the block. That will make it airtight. Don't let them skimp on the scratch coat at the bottom, thinking, oh well, it's going to be covered by skirting, and it doesn't matter. It does matter. And again, your airtightness test will pick that up. So you know. Yeah.
So then air tightness test mid-build should be kind of standard, kind of to warn the builder ahead of time, we'll do a test mid-build,
it's maybe difficult to do that to a certain extent until the thing is sufficiently closed up, by which time it may be difficult to get in and carry out remedial actions. There's a certain amount you can do with,
but it's better than if it's all the way at the end and you have your paint on the wall.
Oh well, that's
so right. Maybe try to do it. Yeah,
it's a certain amount you can I just say you can go around with gap fill foam and mastic and stuff like that, but really there's no substitute for good build quality. Yes, you want to be trying to inspect it as you go along, if at all possible. But you know, yeah, you're absolutely right. That is going to be, you know, what really makes your house an energy efficient house, how it's put together.
Yeah. And so I cut you off there. What's the other things you can do to make sure it's, did I mishear? because apart from like the air tightness tests before you like totally finish the house, I suppose.
Well, I mean, you can get a thermographic imaging camera. Now, they don't tend to be widely used in dwellings, I have to say, unless you have a building that has a particular problem. You think there's a problem, and then you go in and do a survey later on and try and pick out where the problem is. And the problem is usually due to maybe one of two things: either completely missing insulation or poor detailing leading to thermal bridging, especially at junctions of elements and around openings, that kind of thing. And your thermogram can show up relative areas of high heat transfer, heat loss. It's not very common, and to be honest, that needs to be used in the hands of a skilled technician, who can do the survey in the right kind of thermal conditions and interpret the thermogram correctly. So okay.
So it's an added cost again. It'd be an extra test.
It will be an added cost. Speaking about this, one thing I talk about added cost, I should say that your mechanical ventilation system is going to cost a little more. If you want to have your solar tubes like I did, then effectively I'm doubling up on the wood burner could have produced hot water, or more likely if you have a boiler or an air pump that could produce the hot water. So if you then say, well, I want to have some solar tubes, you've got a harder argument to make economically, because you're doubling up on that capacity and you're increasing your capital cost. So because I designed out the boiler, no heat pump, no radiators, or all the piping, that saves a lot of money that you can put into more insulation, the mechanical ventilation heat recovery system. Plus, I'm not only saving on the capital cost, but I have no gas or oil or heating for electricity forever. So that really
turns, and no maintenance cost associated to any
that
system.
That turns the whole argument on its head, because another question that people ask is how much, what is the economic optimum? How much insulation should I put in before it starts to not be worthwhile? Well, if you're designing out a heating system, that turns the whole economic argument on its head, and you can put in a lot more insulation because of the money you're saving on the other components.
Yeah. And get to that 0.2 overall is kind of that magic
number.
Yes,
I mean, that was a figure that I kind of had in my mind. I mean, I wouldn't say that was necessarily, an absolute figure. And of course, that's something that the Passive House software will help you to do. It will help you to do those calculations, and you can see what, is the impact of different specifications.
For sure. Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, listen, thanks so much, Patrick. Really appreciate your time.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure. There's nothing I like talking about more, really. Energy is the only thing I know. And when it comes to my own house, then if I'm not an expert in that, then I don't know what I am.
A pleasure as always, Patrick.
Thanks, Astrid.
That's it for this Self Build Plus podcast episode. Tune in next time for more tips and advice from experts and self-builders alike. And make sure to explore everything Self Build Plus has to offer. The Self Build Plus journey guides you through the process of building and home improving. The Self Build Plus forum allows you to share and learn from other self-builders. While the Self Build Plus videos and our Self Build Plus virtual events are packed with information and advice. With self-build, stop dreaming, start building.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So, Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.